the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. We're going to talk the college scandal, anti-child left, and teacher pay. Brooke, how's it going today?
It's going great. I have recovered since daylight saving time happened on last Sunday, so I feel like I'm finally back in my rhythm and not walking around like a zombie. What about you?
Well, my kids, I could tell, well, especially James, my oldest child, who's two, got a little bit fussy over daylight savings time. So I think, you know, I'm with those politicians that want to get rid of it. I know Trump sent out a tweet, and then, you know, all these people were saying, I'm with Trump now because he said that we got to get rid of the daylight savings time.
I didn't know he tweeted about that.
Or keep it permanent. Yeah, he did. He did. He got a lot of credit. Of course, and then attacks because it was Trump. And then people who were for it.
Right. All of a sudden, they're magically against it
right.
now.
Yeah,
that's how it runs with Trump. So Trump could say the sky is blue. Let's sign a petition that it's green and people are going to freak out. But yeah, I do not like daylight saving time. It completely throws me off my schedule. And I can only imagine you have two little kids, two and under, in your house. So whew. Hats off to you, because it's just hard to get back on schedule.
Yeah, we're not an agrarian society anymore, so I think it's time to change that. And I would love to hear comments for someone to write a really strong defense of why we should keep the status quo and send it into Civitas, because I'd love to read it. And, you know, it's not an issue I've researched real recently, so I would love to read a vigorous and strong defense of why we should keep it the way it is.
So my daughter and I, she's 10 years old, and we were having a discussion because she has been lamenting daylight saving time ever since it happened, because she feels perpetually tired all week long. And so this was the conversation between she and I. It was, Mom, so if daylight saving time never happened, it would really be 8:16 at night instead of 9:16? And I said, yes. And she said, well, how did the government make the time change? And I told her, technically, they didn't make the time change. They only made clocks change. And then she followed that up with, I don't like the government.
I can
That's
understand.
The end.
I mean, if you're a child and you lose an hour
Yeah,
of the night,
you're going to be mad at who did that to you.
You're going to be mad.
So we need some legislation. Come on, y'all.
Yeah.
I think Representative Jason Sain actually introduced something. I have not read the details. And he was posting it on Twitter the other day, and it was talking about some sort of elimination of daylight saving time, or to keep it permanent. So if you guys know about that, let me know what the details are. I will look it up later, too.
Have you been following this college scandal, Brooke? The bribery scandals that have big, I know some of the big universities were USC, maybe UCLA. Wake Forest in North Carolina was embroiled in it a little bit. There was a couple other schools. What do you think? What's going on?
Oh, wow. Yeah. So this has been making headlines as of late. And that's this university scandal where numerous movie stars and just other well-known people have been implicated in bribing their kids' way into college. And of course, I can understand as a parent that you want your child to fulfill their potential, right? You want them to be at the top of their game, to do really well in life. You want to set them up for success. But the question then becomes, how bad do you want it, and what are you willing to do to get that? And for some celebrities, that came with a $500,000 to $6 million price tag, because they were bribing their kids' way into school to fabricate these transcripts and such. And I just think, why are you that committed to having this particular look and reputation that you're willing to commit a crime just to get your kids into school?
Yeah, I think that's the big issue there, Brooke, is so many of these parents, whether they live in Hollywood or some sort of prestigious gated community, they want to convey this sort of notion of success in every aspect and area of their life. They don't want to be broken people. They want to be perceived as broken people, even though we are all broken to some degree. And so, you know, they're willing to go through all kinds of hoops to pay all kinds of money to have their child succeed, at least in their definition, at least in their circle of friends.
An appearance
idea.
Of success.
Yeah, an appearance of success. I think that's really the big issue there. It's a bad look, I feel like, for a lot of colleges, for a lot of sort of folks that consider themselves elite because of maybe the amount of money and property they have and valuables, and sort of foisting their kids upon schools where another individual is losing that slot, you know, is probably lower to middle class white American or lower to middle class Hispanic or Black American that is losing a spot out, because these people that advocate so much for social justice causes in general, not saying all of them, but many of them, decreeing what, you know, colleges should be doing more of to bring in more minorities, or have certain affirmative action policies, or have certain you know, policies in our government to create a level of equality and level the playing field, are demanding that their kids get in because they have more power and they have more money. And they're going around flaunting it in a way that I've really got them caught by the FBI.
Mm-hmm. And what does it teach their kids about character? I think that that's something that on top of, or in addition to my Christian faith, is the fact that I'm setting an example for my kids of what it means to be a person with integrity. And so I think about some of the decisions I make, or temptations that I battle, and think about how my kids are going to perceive me, or what lessons I'm teaching them. And that it serves as a very, I'd say, useful and powerful restraint. And under these circumstances, I think that there is this belief that some people are just above the law, and we know it always plays out badly. Look at Bill Cosby, look at Harvey Weinstein. And so we know that what we reap, we sow, but nonetheless, people continue to try these crazy things.
Yeah. And did you see the Instagram video of Lori Loughlin's daughter on,
yes,
where she was talking about she hates school. She wanted to go to college for the game day experience and the party experience, but she kind of made a comment like, well, all of my followers, you all know, I don't care about school.
And yeah, so why are you going to send your kid to school if they don't care about it? And you have to bribe people to get them into the school. That's problematic. But again, it goes back to how you want to be perceived by others and keeping up with the Joneses. But yeah, it's something that's obviously now come to light, and there's no hiding it. But Lori Loughlin, she was one of my favorite actresses in Full House.
Really?
I really liked her Aunt Becky, and I like her in Wind Calls the Heart. So I'm disappointed, but we're all human. She made a bad decision, and she is now paying the piper.
I had a friend who was out in Hollywood for a while. I think he still lives out there. He said he could get me an autograph of, was it Uncle, who was the not as cool uncle with the blonde hair? Dave Coulier, is that his name?
Steve?
No, there was Uncle Jesse, and was it Uncle Joey?
Yeah, Uncle Joey.
He said he could get me an autograph of Uncle Joey, and I was like in college. I was like, dude, why would I want that?
Thanks,
that's what I
no
always
thanks.
Think about, you know, in Full House. Not that I have anything against that guy. He seems like he's probably one of the more decent guys on that show, because Bob Saget's, if you ever seen
him. Ooh, yeah, he's dirty.
Yeah, he's kind of dirty, old man.
Like what he talks about is very,
yeah,
very off-color.
Very dirty. But anyways, we don't turn this into a Full House episode, but it was a fascinating story. And I think, you know, we talked about this a little bit, but it just showed the hypocrisy of society, where mm-hmm. you have these elements of the left or just sort of Hollywood culture making these decrees, making these demands for government programs and for the leveling of the playing field. But meanwhile, they're peddling influence and peddling favors for their children to get into so-called elite colleges. So that just irks them and bothers them, I think, to most Americans out there who are breaking their backs trying to send their kids to college and trying to play by the rules and study hard and do those things. And you've got these people that come along that make them, you know, they think that they're more special than you are. They're more important than your family. So we play by different rules than your family plays by.
Yep. Definitely a teachable moment for the rest of us that are observing this, and something that we can use to teach our kids. Another thing that we have seen that actually just broke the news earlier, and that is that someone has yet entered the presidential race. He is a Democratic candidate, and as if the field wasn't already crowded enough, this harkens back to 2016 Republican field. Beto O'Rourke is now in the running. So, initial thoughts. Are you really excited?
I actually wanted to ask you, Brooke. I don't want to get too close to your personal space or anything, but when I heard that Beto was running, I didn't get that tingle up my leg. Did you get any sort of sensation from his announcement that he was running? Because I see people on Twitter making these claims, you know, these gasps of, you know, Beto's running, and, you know, shaking everything up, and, you know, that they get some sort of sensation inside that perhaps they're being delivered from, you know.
they're coming out of Egypt.
Yeah. This is sort of like, lead him out of the wilderness. He's leading us out of the wilderness.
You know, like, I wouldn't describe it as a tingle up my leg. I'd describe it more as a rock at the bottom of my stomach that just sunk a little lower, and I feel sick.
I'll give Beto a little bit of credit on one thing, Brooke. He, well, he was profiled in the Wall Street Journal saying he disagreed with socialism. And he's done that again recently where he's made a comment. So he's sort of distancing himself from some of that hard left element of the Democrat Party, trying to position himself possibly maybe as Biden's running mate if Biden's able to capture the nomination, or maybe even a more moderate, you know, plane on the field of the Democratic field. So I think, you know, he does come from Texas. That could be helpful for the Democrats if he's able to secure that nomination, because that's a state that would certainly be a game changer for Democrats if they were able to be more competitive in Texas, maybe not pick it up, but even just be a little bit more competitive there. And he showed that he was able to do that with Ted Cruz when there was a lot of political messianism floating around his campaign. And I think that's one of the problems that we see with Beto and some of the left, and there's some on the right that do this too, but create this whole aura and notion of political messianism, because what they've done now is, you know, this whole notion of materialism and socialism in society has set us upon a path to really recognize the government as our savior, really to recognize government as the answer to our problems, when the founders took a whole different notion and approach to government. Government was there to secure our rights. Government was there to bolster the rights that we already have inherently from God. And now we look to government in many respects to just solve our problems, solve our woes, deliver us from some sort of looming catastrophe, whatever it be, Trump, climate change, or you know, whatever the latest bogeyman is on the left. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's something that we need to think about in terms of our politics, not to get sucked into that messianic fervor that really the government has answers for our lives, that higher power,
right?
You know, is not involved in that respect.
Yeah. So, you know, before, during the 2008 election, that's when I really saw this take place, and it really stood out to me was the way that many Obama supporters viewed and treated him. I remember going to a bookstore in a rural part of the state, and there were these Bible book covers with a profile of Obama on the Bible book cover, and it was, it had the verse 2 Chronicles 7:14 on there. Mm-hmm. If my people would humble themselves and pray, I would hear their prayer and heal their land. And I just, that to me was the absolute manifestation or the tangible way in which people had made him a sort of messianic figure. Like what you were talking about, Oprah essentially anointed Obama.
The one, she called Obama.
Yeah, she called him the one. There was a lot of biblical language that was surrounding him. You made mention of
Chris Matthews called him a New Testament figure.
Yep.
So there's
someone
lots.
Else called him
Jamie
Jesus
Fox
Christ.
Said he was our Lord and Savior.
Yes, yes, that's what it was. And so we see that there, but we also can see it on the right, I would say, with Trump.
Yeah, and that made the news this week a lot with people getting their Trump to sign their Bibles. I mean, you saw that on social media, and there was all kinds of criticism. I didn't react so negatively. Not that I would ever ask the president to sign my Bible. I just think that's a little bit tacky. But some people were saying that that was you know, political messianism. I think some of it had to do with maybe the Bible was the thing that, you know, was dear to their heart. And just
having
a president.
Yes.
You know, it would have been totally different if Obama signed a Bible, or George H.W. Bush, or George W. Bush, or Reagan. I don't think people would have made as much of a fuss about it. So I didn't get so worked up about it. It's not something I would do, is get a president to sign my Bible. Yeah. But
no, I think that that was kind of blown out of proportion. And Bulwark, the Bulwark actually has a good piece by Alan Cross on that, saying that, you know, it wasn't in bad taste. Yeah, it was. However, I don't think it was intended, it wasn't conveying the message that it wasn't intended to convey the message that it did. But I would say what I'm more concerned about, and you know, this is coming from someone who tries to be as objective as possible about President Trump, because there are things that I totally agree with him on and things I absolutely disagree with him on policy wise his character, we can go talk about that another time. But what I'm concerned about is those people that we've seen them on Facebook, maybe you interact with them, who Trump can do no wrong.
Yeah.
And they will defend him to the death for absolutely any policy proposal, whether it's responsible, whether it's constitutional or not. I mean, they just, it doesn't matter. And so any Republican that disagrees with him automatically gets labeled a rhino.
And I think part of that has to do, I'm not defending those people so much, but I think part of that has to do is Trump fights. So Trump, you know, when Trump gets attacked, he hits back twice as hard. And so I think that has a gravitational pull for certain elements of people on the right, is that they finally feel like they have somebody who's fighting for them and who's their voice in Washington and who's not willing to sort of kowtow to the media and to the left like past leaders or past presidents to some degree. But yeah, you're right. I think that's a big problem on the right, is you lose a little bit of critical thinking skills when you're just sort of gravitating to that one huge giant figure, and that includes, you know, people that sort of gravitated towards Obama in that way. And so you have an element that's doing that with Trump as well. I mean, we talked a little bit about this CPAC, is that I saw elements of, you know, where people were cheering Trump on things that, you know, I think that they may disagree with a little bit, but they just become overwhelmed by the moment because they view politics as the answer. Mm-hmm. When I think so much of the problem is elements of culture. If you view sort of political victories and political wins as the only answer in society, then of course you're going to gravitate towards a political figure to steer you that way.
Right. Yeah. That harkens back to, I would say, a Marxist materialistic worldview. When you lose sight of the actual supernatural or anything beyond this life right now, the metaphysical, if you will, you will focus more on the here and now, right? Yeah. And so the solutions for here and now are, in your mind, of eternal importance. And so that was how Karl Marx saw things. And that's how he appealed to the people who didn't subscribe to religion, or even if they did, they still resonated with this idea of equality that Marx was peddling, which was not the founder's version of equality, where there's equal treatment under the law, and that's what equality means, or equality of opportunity. It was equality of outcomes. It was everything, every playing field had to be completely level from birth to grave.
Right. Except for the, you know, apparatchiks who had the control and the
power.
Of course,
right. They're different.
Right. It's
they're
like the when Congress echelon. Passes these laws, whether it be on healthcare, and they exempt themselves from the law, and it's sort of like, man, you know, it's frustrating.
That's
it really
makes
is.
Me sick.
It's frustrating because these people are saying, you know, we're doing this for you, but oh, you know, it's not for us. It's for you guys.
That's the very definition of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And, you know, you play by this set of rules, I play by a different. And no wonder people are so fed up with Congress. If we want a better political system or climate, then we need to expect better of our leaders and expect them to actually hold themselves to the same standard that they hold us to. But back to Beto O'Rourke real quick. So I read a Vanity Fair profile on him, and you heard me reading some of the lines to you in the office because I just was laughing. I thought I was incredulous at it, really. But the name of the article is Beto O'Rourke, I'm Just Born to Do This. And again, it's in Vanity Fair. And just going back to this messianic mentality, one of the lines from it says, but there's also some political poetry to it. A sense that O'Rourke might be destined for this shelf, referring to a shelf of presidential leaders. He has an aura. Most places he goes in El Paso, he's dogged by cries of Beto, Beto. And I just couldn't help but laugh because this is how this reporter is covering him, is as if he is really incarnate, some messiah that is there to lead people out of Egypt, to use the language we were borrowing from earlier. So anyways, that's called, the author of the article actually even refers to him as being a political transcendentalist. So, you know, that's really calling.
Right. They're really going back to that 2008 Obama campaign.
They are. They're trying to replicate it.
And I saw that. I've seen people do that a little bit with Trump's speaking, but I first saw it when I was up in Grand Rapids and living and working up there, and Obama was right outside of our office. He had a rally literally outside of our office, and so we walked down, and I just remember seeing, like, young people had tears in their eyes listening to him speak, and right, he became this sort of light figure, an aura for all their hopes and for all their dreams and for all the ambitions. Obama was going to solve all these problems, and you know, and really, Obama was just repackaging old stale big government, big spending.
Yeah.
That's been repackaged.
He just had a really good charismatic connection with people.
And he was different. I mean, he was a minority, and that was a historic, historic event.
Which was wonderful. In that respect, I think looking how far we've come that we can elect someone that is mixed race like
that.
Yeah,
and has a name like Barack Obama.
Yeah, I think that that's incredible. But I totally disagree with his policies, and I don't believe it is right or moral for us to elect people based on their externals when the content of their character or their policy solutions are making our country worse. Now, granted, I get it. You know, a lot of people in 2016, we felt like we had this binary choice. And so, because some people will say, well, then, you know, where do you stand on Trump? And I'd say that we have to be pragmatic about things and look at what options are actually available. But this is, either way, my hope doesn't come on Air Force One.
Right. Yeah. No, it never should. You should never look to politicians as being the people that can solve your problems. I mean, you hope for virtuous and good politicians, but don't look to them to be the soothsayers and lifesavers of your life, because they will, like every other human being, ultimately, they will not be those people. They will disappoint you. And my suggestion is, having worked up in Washington for a short time, having worked for a congressman who was a very good guy, a decent guy, but if you go up to that culture, I think you're going to see people that are primarily petty, selfish, and will constantly let you down. And that's something to be concerned about in terms of just sort of, if you find yourself looking at a politician or public figure as some kind of savior mm-hmm. in your life or for your circumstances, you will only be let down, folks.
Yep. That is the truth. And I'm sure many of you guys in the audience, listening audience, are nodding your heads in agreement because right. you feel that same way. You're probably not listening to this episode if you felt like everything hinged on one particular political figure. So thank you guys for being part of that, that
being
group
part of that group and movement. Right, exactly.
But let's go ahead. Because speaking of culture, there's something else that has made some news lately that I find concerning, and that is dealing with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's comments on a recent Instagram video wherein she asserted that many millennials, in light of climate change and the world supposedly just going to Hades in 12 years if we don't do different policy things. She said people are questioning whether or not to procreate, whether or not to have children anymore. And so what are some of your initial thoughts on that?
Wow,
statement?
There's so much to unpack there, Brooke. Again, it's sort of this political messianism, right? You're looking to government to solve these things that are primarily outside of the control of government, you know, whether the Earth's going to be destroyed in 12 years. I'm not saying that we should ever pollute, and there's obviously lots of evidence that we're a much cleaner and healthier society than we were even decades ago. So mm-hmm. To say that is completely ridiculous. And so this sort of fervor around climate change, I think, is reaching heights that maybe have unseen, but there were a lot of statements like this going back to the 80s and even 70s where people that there was an ice age was going to emerge or there was going to be this or that. But my initial thoughts is that you're seeing an element of the left, and I'm not going to accuse all people on the left of this, but they're becoming anti-child. It's not they're you know, pro-abortion, which they've been for so long, but it's almost like they're becoming post-abortive that they need an abortion now.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, I highlighted somebody on social media, won't name his name, but he was a CEO of a tech company. He wrote about how, you know, he regretted his biggest regret of him and his wife. They got married. They wanted to have three kids, but they only had one kid. And they said that one kid was the biggest regret of their life. And to see that is just so sad. And it's this element where I think
it breaks my heart.
It is. It's just heartbreaking. But this virtue signaling of, you know, I want to be seen as denying children in a way publicly because of, you know, politics or government. What's going on in that is even more important than my child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's trying to create a new standard wherein foregoing having children is viewed as virtuous.
Right, exactly.
Guess
that's
what
I wanted to say. You said
what other nation did that? China did, right? With their one-child policy, their contribution to reducing carbon emissions, their contribution to alleviating hunger and things like that, among other things, was to enforce this one-child policy. So in America, I think we've got some great political messengers on both sides of the aisle. So, of course, naturally, they aren't going to present outright a one-child policy. But if they can change the conversation and create a sort of virtue signal surrounding not procreating, they're going to do it. And I, like you said, this is also just speaks to this ideology that it's okay to even abort your child after birth, which some people refer to that as a fourth trimester abortion or infanticide, which is what it is. Governor Northam from Virginia can probably tell us more about that. But this is that same group of people that's proposing this sort of thing. So it's, you had said in a recent op-ed that you wrote, there's nothing new under the sun, which comes from the Bible, right?
Ecclesiastes.
Yep. I love that book. But what we're essentially saying is these are recycled ideas and they're just repackaged for a new generation to appeal to a new group. And I'll tell you what, is it is actually appealing to a group, because there was a recent poll out that over one third of those age 18 to mid 30s actually believe that we should take climate change into account when we're deciding whether or not to have more children.
It's cultural suicide, Brooke. And what's funny and ironic in all this is that the left needs kids and more children to pay for all their government programs and spending binges that they want to foist upon all of us. So that, to me, it's in a way self-defeating for them. That's how they are, though. They're very illogical in a lot of their thought. But what it ultimately says, and Brooke covered this better than I could say, but the human person is below the state. That's really what they're saying, is below the here and now. The human person is below my material desires, my wants and my dreams and my hopes for the world. The human person that I will not create is below all that. I will snuff them out if I so choose, because, you know, my utopian paradise hasn't arrived, so I'm going to go take my little rattle and cry in the corner. You know, that's really what it's about, Brooke.
Yeah, I just have that mental picture right now. But no, it's I would say it's Malthusianism just reinvented,
right.
Just to go back over this one more time. And that's Thomas Malthus. I think he was from the 18th century. He was a philosopher, and he believed that people were going to eventually come to a crisis point in the world globally, because we would run out of food because the population was growing faster than we were able to produce more food. And obviously we're still here. Malthus was wrong, because actually with more humans came more productivity, more innovation. And that's just in part because we're created in the image of God. And so we've got this ability to be creative, to be problem solvers, to be innovative. And when you view humans as subservient to the state and the state knowing better, which is what you were just speaking about, then you don't see that kind of potential in humans.
Right.
And so you only see them as liabilities.
Right.
And that's what they're doing, really, is essentially saying, you're a liability, you're going to impact my quality of life, or I'm going to pretend I'm being compassionate, and because I don't think you're going to have a good quality of life, I'm going to deny you life. And so they're having the wrong conversation from the start. And so it's time that we infuse them with a little bit of understanding of human nature and really who man is and what we're capable of.
Right. Let's hit teacher pay to close this out real quick. We got some excellent articles by Bob Lupke on our website. Go read those. But Brooke, have you seen all the debate in North Carolina politics over teacher pay? I wonder, this is kind of my initial thought anytime I see these teacher pay debates, which just continue on and on in North Carolina. I think conservatives and Republicans are doing a little better job of responding on these issues. But they get trapped in this by Governor Cooper and by Democrats, because they're always willing to spend more. They're always willing to say, we'll raise it higher and higher. And, you know, moving up to number 29th nationally and second in the Southeast is never enough. Bob said something like, I think average teacher pay in North Carolina now works out to be a little bit under $54,000. And he said the total compensation package was around 70 something. So it's something that's gone up continually, I think maybe 5 or 6 straight years in North Carolina. But what do you think about when you're seeing this issue constantly debated here in North Carolina?
I'd say that we're largely allowing pro-unions or unions and the governor to deliver the boundaries by, or the lens through which we look at teacher pay. And so if somebody gets to determine the narrative and we have to fight on those terms, then we're always going to have a losing battle. And really what we need to do is come up a little higher, help the North Carolina people come up a little higher and look at this more objectively and more fairly. And for example, Governor Cooper proposed a 9.1% average teacher pay increase in his latest budget. Do you think he would actually propose something like that if he were in elected office in the General Assembly and he had to be accountable for his budget and had to clean up after his own mess? Like, could he really fund that sustainably? I don't think so. I think that he is shooting for the moon because he knows that other people are going to have to tell him no, and he's going to look like he's the champion and pro-teacher.
Yeah, right. He's going to play to his constituencies. And really the big answer on this issue, Brooke and I, we talked about it earlier, is implementing a position of merit pay. Implementing a policy of merit pay, and that would really attract better teachers into that field. We've got a lot of great teachers in North Carolina now, obviously, but I think you would even attract a larger talent pool if people thought, hey, I have a chance to make maybe $70,000, $80,000 earlier. I won't have to wait 20, 25 years for my pay scale to jump quite as significantly. So I think that's something to consider in North Carolina. It's something, of course, the teacher unions are against. They just want to do the old stale model of, you know, this is how much you get paid after you sit in this desk for 20, 30, 40 years, and it's all about time served. And so we really don't have a model of merit pay. And I think that would be a good reform for the state. But I think we need to think just differently about education just overall. I think we need to do some reforms, because the status quo, we continue to throw money at a problem. And there's breakdowns. There's problems with education and sort of stagnant results. And so part of the answer, obviously, is more school choice, more opportunity scholarships.
Which Governor Cooper proposed phasing out, by the way.
Right,
he doesn't want opportunity scholarships.
He's going to do everything the unions ask for. And I think the big thing that's frustrating, we're going to talk maybe about problems on the right in a future podcast. There's a lot of them. But one of the problems on the left that I continue to see, and I know you agree with me on this, on Brooke, is that so many of the ideas are just stale policies from the 60s, 70s, even before, where it's just more tax, more spend, and government knows best. And they don't really offer up any dynamic differences in terms of policy. We're just going to repackage the way that we package it,
well, that's,
so to speak. And
okay,
they do a good job. I mean, give them credit. They do a good job of packaging these stale policies for decades.
Case in point, the Green New Deal,
right?
I mean, like, they didn't even want to come up with another new name. They just put green in front of it and, you know, regurgitated Franklin Roosevelt's policy. Mind you, they talked about eliminating air travel. So there was that difference. But no, it's just what you said was really the underpinning mindset and philosophy behind these policies that they propose is the same. It's stale. It's been tried before and it has failed before. So let's have something new. And that's why we want to continue to keep you guys informed with new policy proposals, which is what we do here at Civitas.
Yeah, check us out, nccivitas.org.
Yeah, so thank you guys for joining us this week. We have to wrap it up, but if you have any questions or comments for us, we always welcome you here, you sharing those with us. So send us an email at radio@nccivitas.org. And as always, you can subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play by looking up Civitalk, C-I-V-I-T-A-L-K. Have a good week.
Thank you.